aren't these daughters of Persia retelling that myth as we speak? And from that, you know, they put their hair down, sort of speak. Rudabe has put her hair down. And, but this time, maybe from this union, there will be a baby girl that will be born. And this new epic female hero will sort of transform this land. Because I think something has happened. It's an event. And whether we like it or not, there's going to be a before and after. We've observed the birth of Rudabe's daughter in every single one of these girls. And it's, we know in psychoanalysis that these things are not, you know, it's not something that can just happen, then that the birth of a subject, it's a process. And I think that it's a birth, this birth of Rudabe's daughter that's been long overdue, but also a long time in the making. And I personally, I'm sorry, I get very emotional, but I look forward to her becoming.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Gohar Homayampour. Dr. Homayampour is a psychoanalyst in Tehran. And our conversation takes place on October 10th, 2022, and everyone listening knows that it's in the midst of political turmoil. And while we planned this conversation before the current arrest, she decided that it was important to go forward with it. We discussed the political situation. We discussed the remarkable courage of the young women who are, with their bodies and lives and vision for themselves, trying to make a difference for themselves and the future of the country. And she shares with us what it's like to be a part of that and witnessing that. We then focus ourselves on her book, her latest book, called Persian Blues, Psychoanalysis and Mourning. This is her second work. Her first was the very well-regarded Doing Psychoanalysis in Tehran, which won the Gradiva Award and was translated into many languages. We talk about concepts that are really very important to her, the notion of foreignness, the notion of the subversive nature of psychoanalysis, and the importance of the functioning of the third, which we spent some time on. Tolerating discomfort and not relying on sameness. She has some thoughts freed from perhaps Western political limitations to comment on what's happening in her eyes on the West with identity politics and political correctness, and how she sees that as fundamentally anti-psychoanalytic. We also talk about the blues, a real love of hers, And she obviously takes delight in it. She recognizes both its reference to the color, which is important in Persia, and the state of mourning, which is a thread throughout the book, but especially the music. The way she characterizes it is it lives on the edge of melancholy and also contains a great joy in it. We learn that Freud was first translated into Farsi before Freud was translated into French. It was early as 1906, and she is one of the founders of the Freudian group of Tehran. What's important for me is to be in touch with someone who's closer to this vital struggle, and to hear a person so full of life and so full of promise for herself, her community, and her future. I hope you find it as meaningful, as important, and as educational as I did. I learned a great deal. And again, her book is, as the title suggests, it's really a poetic take in her inimitable style that you'll quickly come to appreciate. I hope you enjoy the book and my conversation with Gohar Homayampour. Gohar, welcome to the podcast. I'm especially glad that you're with us. Gohar, you and I started discussing having this conversation well before the current political uprising taking place in Iran. And when things started becoming violent and dangerous, I reconsidered and I said, perhaps it would be best if we put this off. And you and I spoke about that. And you thought it was important to have this conversation with being careful at the same time. And here we are. And I'd like to start us off by reading something from your book, which very much relates to the current situation. And of course, this was written in your book. The book, again, the title is Persian Blues, Psychoanalysis and Mourning. This was written well before the current uprising. And you write the following. Even though much has been written about the politics of psychoanalysis, and about the psychoanalysis of politics, there is little to be found in the literature about the socio-political context of the analytic practice and about the impact of political events outside of the analytic situation onto the analytic process inside the session. You ask, my question is, how would a major political crisis in wider society affect the unfolding of the analytic process within the session? Close quote. Well, there is no more apt way to begin this conversation than with those thoughts. And with that, Gohar, let me invite you to share whatever feels right for you to share so our listeners can get a sense of what the world you're living in is like. Just to note the time, we are having this conversation on October 10th, 2022.
Hi, Harvey. Yes, I'm glad you highlighted that we plan to have this conversation, and then you kindly worried if it was safe for me to have this conversation. And I thought that it's important at the same time to find a way. This is what many of us have been doing throughout the years, to find a nuanced way to be able to continue what we do here, which I think it's important. And at the same time, to stay faithful to our own sense of ethics. So along those lines, it would be against my sense of personal ethics not to say anything about what's going on. You know, I think one of the most important feminist movements of our times are happening. There was a message, there was a video message sent, I don't know if you've seen it or not, by the famous Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, and I think it was very important what he said, because he said it's not just that from a, you know, this position of superiority in the West we support these girls, or that these girls should be supported, but that we can learn from them, that we can learn from this uprising, which for me has very specific criteria. I think unlike some of the feminist movements we've seen in the West, this one doesn't exclude men. You know, it's so interesting how in this geography, it has become blatantly clear that the freedom and emancipation of men and women are inherently intertwined. And I think there's value in this. And as Zizek reminds us, we can learn from it, not just support it. In general, this is a feminist movement that doesn't exclude. You know, this started with the death of this Turkish woman, Mahsa Amini, 4 weeks ago on September 16th. And I think that, but it's interesting that it hasn't become about identity politics. Her Kurdishness is not emphasized, which I think it's brilliant. And I was thinking sort of with myself that the Kurdish separatist movement in Iran should feel more than ever that they belong not to Iran, but with Iran, as vice versa, as we with them, because one of their daughters gets killed and everybody goes into the streets because she's a daughter of Persia. So I think all of these different elaborations, I think there is an invitation on the part of this movement towards cohabitation, towards freedom of choice, because there is, unlike, you know, what I find it's often portrayed by the mainstream Western media, which is at oftentimes hypocritical, but there are veiled women in this struggle as well, side by side.
Not often appreciated here in the West.
Yes, you know, it's just against obligatory hijab. And I think this sort of invitation for cohabitation that they're showing, it just takes my breath away. You know, I was thinking about this right before our podcast, so it's the first time I'm sharing this idea of mine, that there is a myth. It's called Ruda Be'anzal in our Book of Kings, which is the main source of Iranian mythology. And like the Rapunzel fairy tale, Rudabe sort of lets down her beautiful dark lock of hair to her lover, Zal, and it cascades down her tower. And Zal climbs up to Rudabe, and from that union in this signifier of hair, which is more important than ever in my geography at this moment, from that union, a baby boy is born named Rostam, who becomes the epic hero of Iranian mythology, one who defends this land into prosperity with courage and hospitality and cohabitation. And I was thinking, Harvey, that could we retell that myth at this particular moment, considering everything that's going on? Because Ruda Be'anzal didn't end up having a daughter. And I was thinking, should we retell the myth? Aren't these daughters of Persia retelling that myth as we speak? And from that, you know, they put their hair down, sort of speak. Rudabe has put hair down. But this time, maybe from this union, there will be a baby girl that will be born. And this new epic female hero will sort of transform this land, because I think something has happened. It's an event, and whether we like it or not, there's going to be a before and after. We've observed the birth of Rudabe's daughter in every single one of these girls, and we know in psychoanalysis that these things are not, you know, it's not something that can just happen, that the birth of a subject, it's a process. And I think that it's a birth, this birth of Rudabe's daughter, that's been long overdue, but also a long time in the making. And I personally, I'm sorry, I get very emotional, but I look forward to her becoming.
Is there more that you would either like or expect from feminists from the West, or anyone else for that matter? But let's start with the feminists from the West.
It's very tricky, you know, because on the one hand, I think it's very important, some of the, you know, for the voices of Rudab's daughter, which I don't dare to name because it's something that we have to name together with time. It's important that the voices are heard, but at the same time, I think that what Zizek also reminded us in the message he sent is very important, that this cannot be done from a superior point of view. This has to be done as an invitation towards an encounter, you know? So I think that's the part that is very important for me to emphasize. It goes without saying that it's very important that the voices are heard, and that it's sort of, I'm sure, helps the spirit. There's no question about that. But it's the same thing, you know, I always, basically, you know, I'm part of this group, Geographies of Psychoanalysis, and the mission of that, which is led by Lorena Preta, the Italian psychoanalyst, is the same position that we take there about psychoanalysis that I think it's important to be reminded of in this situation as well, which, you know, we say there that it's not that we transplant psychoanalysis, for example, to Iran, but that we put it to work, and that in this encounter, both subjects transform and change. So I think, yes, it's very important, all that's happening, and appreciated, I'm sure, and necessary. At the same time, I like these nuances to be kept in mind.
What you're describing is, of course, the coming together in the analytic dyad, where both parties are influenced. And while there's an asymmetry, that's almost aside from the point when things get mixed up and co-created together. And now you're saying that that needs to be the case for feminists and all caring people come together to aid the liberation. Is that too dramatic a statement, or do you think that captures it?
No, yeah, I think you capture it well. I think you capture it very well, because I think, as I said, what's happening in this particular uprising, it's so special in so many different layers that there is quite a bit to learn from, you know?
Mm-hmm, sure. If nothing else, the remarkable courage. What we see here in the West, the remarkable courage of these young women to stand together, stand alone, and demonstrating the freedom, their autonomy, and their vision for their future, often with lethal consequences. Let me shift our attention. That's possible only to a certain degree, but let's try. You write in your book about the foreignness of psychoanalysis. That includes your own foreignness, which I will ask you to share with our listeners, what your own geographical foreignness has been, and also a state of mind of foreignness. And again, to read a couple of sentences, you write about analysts, you write, they are not psychopharmacologists, they are not humanists. They don't necessarily even have to be good people, in my unpopular opinion. But they are nomads, marginal, and always in search of the unconscious. This, to me, is not a vision of psychoanalysis that can be compromised, not in the name of infantilizing our patients to death, not in the name of being really kind and good, and not in the name of a politically correct discourse of our time. There's a lot in there. Why don't we start with the easy part? Tell us about your geographical journeys through your life and your perhaps inherent foreignness.
Well, I was born in Paris and educated in North America, so Canada and United States for a few years. Between I was 6 to about 12, I did live in Iran. But before I sort of came here about now, believe it or not, about 15 years ago, I hadn't really ever lived here, you know, because I did I lived in North America since I was 13, between Canada and then the States.
And so do you carry a sense of being an outsider on the basis of that?
Absolutely, I do. But, you know, my take on this, which I think is a premise in the book, which is not maybe so different to everything else also that we've been saying, is that, but for me, that has never been a handicap. It's something to be celebrated. It's, you know, I think psychoanalysis, as the Argentine psychoanalyst Mariana Horenstein says, it's a process of foreignization. And so in a sense, for me, that has never been something that I felt is a handicap. It doesn't mean that it didn't come with its own set of troubles of the soul and discontent, but it was always something that allowed me to, I think, maybe be more equipped to read between these sort of accented lines, to sort of understand these voices on the margin. This, no, you know, I think it's a great place to be a nomad. And there's a freedom in that. And there's, you know, you can't get away from this idea of difference there. And, you know, this is one of the things in about foreignness that it's significant, and it's very much related to this idea of thirdness, you know, because I think often in the, you know, even with good intentions, we the bottom line is that we try to get rid of difference in the name of assimilation, in the name of cultural relativism. I have a good example. Should I tell you that example?
Yeah, yeah, yes, it's a great example.
So I had a few years ago, I tell this story often because I think it beautifully encapsulates much better than I can in the words of this patient what I'm trying to communicate. So she was an Iranian patient living in the States, and she was here for the summer, and she had asked for an appointment to come and see me. And so when, you know, in sort of an interview session, I said, so, you know, what's going on? And she said, I've been in analysis with someone in the States, with an American analyst, and I like to start with you. And I said, but that doesn't make sense. You live there, and why? And then she said, because my American analyst is so nice. She's tried so hard to read about the Iranian culture, to understand my Iranian culture. I just want to be in analysis with someone who I won't be named the Iranian patient. I just want to be a patient. And she finished it with saying, I'm hoping you're not going to claim to know my Iranian culture, which I ended up working with her, which I didn't know anything about her Iranian culture, which was quite different than mine. So I think, you know, let's imagine this American analyst with the best of intentions, with really trying to, I think, be hospitable to this Iranian woman who has started analysis with him or her. But at the same time, isn't something going on at a deeper level that's about eliminating difference? About sort of against alterity? Why couldn't they take this as an opportunity that they're different, then they come from different cultures, and that's fine? She did it. So, you know, I think these are very much along the ideas that I have, that, you know, at the end, there is a tendency towards eliminating difference, which I think it's a critique of mine towards contemporary psychoanalysis, as well as towards the spirit of our times and with the politically correct and all of that, that I talk quite a bit in the book about.
You speak very eloquently about your feelings about political correctness, and you call it at one point the authoritarianism of our time. And let me elaborate your story and read a few sentences where you give your take on that example of what you think is amiss, at least as represented by this one particular patient. And you write, Maybe the crisis of psychoanalysis in the West has to do with this very phenomena. Maybe the harder we try to fit psychoanalysis into the capitalist model of the customer is always right, maybe the more we try to cleanse it of anything that made anyone feel uncomfortable, such as unconscious fantasy, sexuality, and in short, maybe the more politically correct we become in order to attract customers, the less desirable we became for analysands. We became mainstream to make ourselves more attractive, but alas, we lost all desirability and mystery in the process, did we not? As part of your attunement to authenticity and differences, you write a great deal about the third and the limitations of the binary and the subversiveness of our field. Can you develop that a little bit more? There's one observation you make that sort of stood out for me. Much has been written and said, and wisely so, about the presence of the third in development. But I've never heard your comment, which is that the toddler gets familiar with the third not only through the usually understood method of there's another person, it's baby, mother, and. You add to that, you don't dispute that, but you add to that that another way to get there is by mother, baby, and mother's interest in something else other than baby. That's another way to encounter the third for the baby to see and feel that they're not only and always the center of the universe. And this is both a theoretical construct and also the challenge of all mothers who live lives, but also, as you point out, at work, as you do. And you're a mother, and so you've known this. Want to elaborate that for us?
Yes, you know, I think that it becomes crucial for the development of the mind in the baby, and we know this very well in psychoanalysis, that there's a third, that intervenes between the mother and the child. But as you said, this is often associated with the third presence of another person. But I think there is a paradox on this, because often we find that even when there is a presence of the father, for example, if the mother does not desire the father, that the third cannot resume its function of the third. So I think what becomes necessary to highlight is that the third is always inherently within the desire of the mother. And if the mother has desires outside of her child, whatever it is, it can be her job, that will have the function of a third for the development of the mind of the infant. You know, because I think the example of there's often the presence of a father, but if the mother doesn't desire her, it cannot assume that role for the child often to be able to intervene. In order for it to become that potential, that person, let's say the father here, because this would apply to families with all kinds of constellations, as long mm-hmm. as there is a third that would intervene between this dyadicness of the mother and the child. And this can only be via the route of the desire of the mother, if it's a desiring mother, because a mother that just desires her child is not really a desiring mother.
Well said.
But I also wanted to say something you said previously about this idea of psychoanalysis in the West. And, you know, I think that's an important question that I try to address in the book, which is, it's a question we should ask ourselves. If we see this sort of decline of psychoanalysis in the West, in a sense of, you know, it's an unsophisticated way to put it, but, you know, just concretely by the fact that they're not, we don't find as many people interested in analytic training, for example. Mm-hmm. And then in countries like Iran, Turkey, China, we see this boom of psychoanalysis. I think it's an important question to ask ourselves, why? And one of the ideas I have, which has to do with what you read, is that we try to get rid of anything that is a disturbance. that is uncomfortable. We try to go with this motto of the customer is right, but in the sense of, you know, let's not talk about anything that makes you feel uncomfortable. Let's not say anything that makes you feel uncomfortable. And this is in order to make ourselves more desirable, but it hasn't worked out that way. And I think then wisdom should make us ask, then why? Maybe because, you know, when we try to do that, we got rid of everything that could make psychoanalysis desirable in the first place, which are my ideas. And I just wanted to make a brief comment about that because you had mentioned it.
Sure, sure. Your book is not only about discomfort, though, because you speak at length about the blues and your knowledge and your feel for the blues, I'm referring to the musical form, is very rich and nuanced. And it's obviously something that comes from your soul. But you elaborate blues. Blues refers to a color. Blues refers to a state of mourning and also the music. Help us feel your relationship to the blues in any of those facets.
You know, Charlotte Fontaine, who's one of the pioneers of the blues in Philadelphia, she wrote after she managed to work through her depression in her diary, she wrote that the songs could only be sung with a full heart and a troubled spirit, if I don't remember exactly her quote. And I always thought that that's not such a bad description of psychoanalysis also, no? That we could do this job with a full heart and a troubled soul and troubled spirit. And I, you know, in this, like, I think it might be interested for people to hear that Duke Ellington did a tour and which led him to play in jazz clubs in Tehran and Isfahan, 1963. And what struck me was that after he played in jazz clubs in Isfahan and Tehran, he changed the name of, according to many critics, one of the most beautiful songs of that album from Elf to Isfahan. And I always thought, you know, I always wondered and imagined and fantasized what must have happened that, you know, propelled him to change the name. He must have been touched by something in this land, in this geography. And for me, the most beautiful thing about the blues is that it's always, you're always on the edge of falling into melancholia. It's about betrayals and discontent and broken hearts and bad lovers. And just when you're about to fall into that, the next beat will take you to a possibility of a beyond, a possibility of an afterward, the possibility of mourning, in a sense. And I think that that can only have come from, you know, the laments of ex-slaves and their descendants, because they the blues, like psychoanalysis, is the voice of the margin. It's the voice of the underground. And so for me, this is the beauty of it. You know, it's a genre of music that's not about eroticizing sadness. It's not about falling into it, but it's about transforming it, playing with it, dancing to it. And you know, and I think the blues songs are often really funny, you know.
Funny. Tell me funny. I wasn't going to guess you were going to say that.
Well, because, you know, there's just genuine humor in these blues songs, you know. But I had put them there to show examples of how, you know, that they're often funny. You know, there's always this humorous way of approaching pain or betrayals. I mean, I don't want to get politically incorrect on your podcast, but something like...
you can feel free, I promise you.
if you're not going to love me, I know your sister will, you know? Something along these, you know, there's always these... this sort of humor inherently within it.
Ah. Well, let me ask you about that. I don't want to lose your voice about this carefulness, which you are subject to as well, apparently. Your sentence, you write that analysts don't even have to be good people, which you add in my unpopular opinion. Well, you know, I enjoy the sort of talking about humor, the playfulness of that statement. I'll take it at face value and also enjoy the humor of it. What do you mean by that?
You know what I mean is that I think we claim that we analyze every part of ourselves as analysts. And yet I think we tend not to analyze our wish for goodness or our wish to cure or our wish to be really good human beings. And I think that should not get a carte blanche, as the French would say. It should not get a free card about not being analyzed, because we know very well, for example, how dangerous our goodness and our desire to cure too fast a severe melancholia could be. It could, you know, it could turn into a very dangerous mania, for example, right, just out of the goodness of the analyst's heart. And I think that, for example, it could be that sometimes this kind of goodness is used as a defense against working with aggression within the session. For, you know, just to give you a few examples that are, you know, I think more understandable. And then, you know, I think we forget, you know, we sort of repress Freud's assertion to his pastor, Protestant pastor friend that, you know, in order for, you know, in order for you to do something that could have result, you have to be in touch with this part of yourself, that a little bit of sort of badness is necessary. Or we know Winnicott telling us about the ruthlessness that is part and parcel of creativity, that there is an unawareness of that object at that moment. And I think that this sort of gets, let's say it's not contemporary psychoanalysis, a strong point in my mind, because, and I think that maybe that tendency, and we know this is multi-layered, of course, but part of it at the same time has to do with, at the same time, eliminating difference, eliminating unconscious, you know, the sort of the voice of the unconscious in a way. Because then you don't get into muddy territories within this discourse that I'm presenting. And I mean, we know the discourse of the unconscious is only muddy, you know. So the moment we try to move away from that, I think we should check ourselves and analyze ourselves about what we're really trying to get away from. I mean, again, didn't Freud say that if one day you're talking about psychoanalysis and describing it and you don't get hostile reactions, you should be sure that you didn't explain it well?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that it takes my speaking with someone who's not only not here in the West, but is in a country where there isn't, and we're about to speak of this, where isn't a formally organized psychoanalytic community, that you're the one who brings to our attention this addiction to sameness, this the limitations of what's called identity politics, the falseness of it, and you're the one who's calling us to listen to the truth of, we could call it Freud's message, we could call it what we've learned over the centuries, the method of listening to ourselves wherever it takes us, beyond the nice part of us. You would think it would be an automatically familiar message, but you have to remind us of that. And for that, I thank you. And hopefully you will stir conversation throughout the psychoanalytic community by saying, you know, nice is nice, but it's, and when people need it, it's not, you're not suggesting it should be deprived of them. But it's only one facet of relating. There's much, much more we can offer people than niceness. Maybe that's what I mean to say. There's much, much more we can offer people than niceness. And only we can offer it because we are presumably freed from the need to satisfy our own niceness and are dedicated to understanding their truth wherever it takes us.
Absolutely. I think, that's beautifully said, and thank you for saying that. And I think that, you know, I think because of my own foreignness, because of my life history, you know, it's easier to maybe see these things because you are operating from a point that's on the margin. And this is one of the things that's marvelous about doing psychoanalysis in Iran, because, you know, you cannot escape these kinds of discourses, you know, and you continuously have to read between these accented lines at the edge of language. You know, it sort of allows you in a funny way, as you're pointing out, in a paradoxical way, to practice it in its original revolutionary form somehow. Yeah. And I think, I think what you're pointing out is, first of all, very nice for me to hear. Thank you. And also, I think it sort of encapsulates what we're talking about.
I had not known many things before I read your book, but one of the things I hadn't known was the history of Freudian thinking in Tehran. Let me read a piece about that. You write, I was surprised to discover that this desire for psychoanalysis in Iran is not a new phenomenon. It has always been there. Many of Freud's writings were translated into Farsi as early as 1906. Some of his books were translated into Farsi before they were translated into French. And yet nothing systemic has come out of it. And it is as if the desire remains fragmented, not finding its way towards a cohesive becoming. Well, you've stepped up and have tried to address that in establishing and leading the Freudian group of Tehran. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I think that yes, me and many of our colleagues, our group, other groups have really, we've stepped up together. And I really believe that all of this effort has changed the landscape of psychoanalysis in Iran for generations to come. It's any case, one of the, you know, proudest moments of my career. And what you're referring to was very interesting for me, because I did some research and I saw 1906 Freud was translated. Not just one text, quite a few texts were translated into Farsi. And then some texts were translated earlier than they were into French. And I, you know, this struck me. And again, I think this would be an excellent study to try to find out why it didn't find this like cohesiveness until recently, that I think with a lot of efforts of a great number of people, that's happening. But I was talking to a colleague in Turkey, and she had similar feelings about Turkey, for example, that there was, you know, that it's the same thing. There's desire for psychoanalysis and Freud's writing very early on, but it took a very long time for it to assume this sort of more structural, cohesiveness. And so I think this is a very interesting thing that I just observed. That, not that I have many answers but I, this was an interesting observation for me. And, you know, on the other hand, like, I think it's conflictual, because as soon as I said structural cohesiveness, I thought maybe that's not the best way, because the lack of structure, in a sense that I think lack of structure is not the right word, but for example, the fact that the Freudian group of Tehran, we do not have any official registration with the Iranian government, nor are we affiliated with any international organization. And I think this somehow has led to quite a lot of the exact discourse that we've been talking about. It leaves it on the margin. It gives you a sense of freedom. It gives you a sense of creativity. I think you would all be extremely impressed with our candidates the way their mind, you know, their analytic, their really brilliant analytic mind. And I think this sort of format has helped this seed of psychoanalysis. On the other hand, which is a lament, because I don't want to present I'd be the last person to want to present an idealized form of anything. But, you know, not only we've had our own set of laments that comes with, I think, pioneering situations, but also in this regard that often you find that, you know, this sort of cohesiveness is also missing maybe within the analytic discourse that they're presenting, because they're so excited and they become maybe jack of all trades and masters of none somehow. And again, this cohesiveness, I think it has to be sort of encouraged and worked on with them. And, you know, but it's paradoxical because you don't want to kill the creativity, the desire, the excitement, you know. So it's, you know, it's, again, one of these things that I think it's nuanced and complicated. But the desire is there.
There's always that tension, the tension between the excitement and the nuance. And exactly. And it's the growing pains of a young, delighted group of students. How many people are there? And I know they're in multiple cities.
So I can only tell you about our group, the Freudian group of Tehran, which... I think when I wrote the book, there were 250 people, mostly in Tehran and Mashhad, which you all would be very surprised to know. It's one of the most religious cities in Iran, and it's been where, you know, the group has found quite a bit of desire. I think we're a little bit more now, but the interesting thing is that we have never advertised, never, in any sort of form. And every year we have more people interested to come and get training with us than we are able to offer them, unfortunately, because of lack of resources. But this is, you know, considering that we can't really offer them any degree or any certificate, it's, I think that's quite incredible that they just come because they have a desire for psychoanalysis and just that.
You know, the tension you just described between the enthusiasm and the limitations of that enthusiasm, as I become aware of listening to you and the delight of listening to you, and also the content, both of what you say and of what you describe in the psychoanalytic fervor in Iran. And then, of course, I pause and I think back to our beginning conversation and the circumstances that when we disconnect, you will be living in the politically dangerous, riotous, and pivotal time in your country's life. We too are left with the excitement of what you describe and the terrible uncertainty and worry about what also is going to be happening. And when you say that we would be impressed with your candidates, I'm sure we would. And maybe that's a sign of coming together that at some point, we will all be able to share the beauties of Tehran. Everybody I know who has spent time there just raves about what a special place it has been, and perhaps it still is. And I look forward to the day of our meeting, not just online across the oceans, but in person, and spending time together. In safety and in freedom. I want to thank you, Gohar, really. It's been, I'm so glad we were able to do this. I'm so glad you're open and able to share yourself as warmly and beautifully as you do. And all I can say, and I'm speaking for myself, and I'm confident for many others, we wish you, and not just the psychoanalytic community, but your vibrant country, better times ahead.
Thank you, Harvey. Thank you for this conversation, and thank you for your thoughtfulness and warmth, which means quite a lot, particularly at this moment. And, you know, I write against hope, and I write in praise of hopelessness in my book. And I have to tell you, but I'm an active pessimist. And when you see every single one of these girls, you cannot help but be hopeful that what you're saying, I really think will be possible, because, you know, when you see the birth of these girls and this uprising, it takes one's breath away.
Indeed. Be well.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.